Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you had a great weekend. And if you joined us Saturday night at the sold-out theater at Ace Hotel downtown, hope you had a great time as we watched Blade Runner, the final cut on the big screen at the Ace. What a fun night. Hearing everybody respond when November 2019 came up on the screen early in the film and everybody acknowledging there we are, the very same month depicted in the film. It was just a lot of fun. So we have many more events, of course, coming up related to Film Week at the Theater at Ace Hotel, and we'll keep you updated. In fact, later this week, tickets will go on sale for our annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. So we'll have all the info about that as well. Well, very busy past few days in politics, no question, including news that was made this morning as the House Intelligence Committee released the depositions and testimonies that were taken by former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and former senior State Department advisor Michael McKinley. House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff talked about what was learned from former Ambassador Yovanovitch's testimony.
It is someone who also is one of the first witnesses to this irregular back channel that the president established with Rudy Giuliani and the damage that it was doing to America's national security and foreign policy interests. How it was working at in opposition, not in support of U.S. policy objectives. Ambassador Yovanovitch had a well-earned reputation as a fighter of corruption, and she was working with Ukraine to get Ukraine to fight corruption. And so what does this irregular back channel sanctioned by the president do? It seeks to remove someone fighting corruption in Ukraine.
Adam Schiff, L.A. area Congress member and chair of the House Intelligence Committee. In that testimony from the former ambassador to Ukraine, she says that she became aware from Ukrainian officials that the Trump administration was targeting her for removal. Also in the testimony provided by former senior State Department advisor Michael McKinley, he says he was concerned in what he thought was the administration's push to have Ukraine do the political bidding of the administration, said that it was the first time in his 30-plus years in the State Department that he had seen an administration behave in that way. Joining us to talk about these and other important political issues, the dean of Pepperdine School of Public Policy and senior fellow at Pepperdine's Davenport Institute, Pete Peterson. Dean Peterson, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Great to be back with you, Larry.
And the president of Emerge America, national organization identifying and training Democratic women to run for political office, Amanda Renteria. Amanda, great to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me.
Pete, let me start with you on the first of these testimonies, the transcripts coming out with the release from the Senate Intelligence Committee. This is in at least partial response to Republicans saying that the process has all been closed with no public scrutiny.
Right. Well, I think the public stage of this process is now opening with a vote last week. And so the criticisms, I think, waged verifiably, legitimately by Republicans that so much of this had happened behind closed doors with rather tempered and specific leakings coming out throughout the process has now become public. And so we're just at the front end of the public stage of the process. And, this has always been a political process, in my view. One that has been attempted to engender public support for impeachment and removal. And so now we head into the public portion of the process.
Amanda, do you think that, I mean, given that there has been so much leaking and release of opening statements alike, do you think the release of the transcripts will have much effect on public opinion about the impeachment inquiry?
Well, I think it's important that it's out there in the full for people to read. and to judge for themselves. I also think that this is just the beginning. There's going to be a lot more testimony. These are the first two coming out, and we're going to see a lot more. And what's going to happen over time is people do get educated. They are able to corroborate stories of what is or isn't true. Certainly, there's a lot of information out there, but I will say people reading the back and forth does seem to get attention, at least on Twitter. We'll see whether that affects the voting communities out there.
Amanda, we also have a couple of setbacks for President Trump. This morning, a federal appellate court in New York ruled that the president's tax returns can be turned over to state criminal investigators by his personal accountant. This from the Second Circuit Court of Appeal. Now, that's undoubtedly going to be appealed. I mean, this could end up being a Supreme Court case as to whether the president's accountant has to comply with the demand for the tax returns. The president also suffering a court setback on those wanting to come into the United States having to prove that they have health insurance. Amanda, your thoughts on the two cases?
You know, I think there's no doubt that this president will take it to the Supreme Court. I think he has taken it'll delay the process as much as possible, which is what he has been doing on his tax returns. And it looks like we're going to go right down those steps. But listen, he feels pretty competent in the Supreme Court as opposed to in any other, or at least in New York. And so we're going to see more of this stuff pushed to the Supreme Court. And I think that's the precursor for his presidential election as well. He will talk. You will see every Republican candidate often talks about the implications of the Supreme Court, and I think you will see him lean into that, not only in what he is dealing with, but in policies as well as in the presidential election that's coming.
Pete Peterson, your thoughts on the President Trump's rough go in court? I mean, it's been 3 years of, it seems like 90% of court decisions have gone against him.
Well, Larry, I thought when you were mentioning Blade Runner before, you were actually describing President Trump's campaign towards 2020. One of my favorite movies, by the way, I'll just interject.
Great film.
There.
Yeah.
But there are a number of blades that the president is running. These ones relating to his tax returns is certainly one. And I agree with Amanda that he finds more favorable footing if this does, in fact, go to the Supreme Court than he does in these lower courts. But as we have seen in a number of these issues, it's a waiting game in large part. He's trying to get this pushed as far back as he can. And I think he's also, and he's done this in several other areas, he's very happy to push these rabbit holes that opponents are willing to go down to attack him. I think it actually builds this larger narrative that the whole world, on the left at least, is against the president. And he's happy to keep that those fires burning.
We're talking with Pete Peterson, the dean of Pepperdine School of Public Policy, also with us Amanda Renteria, who was national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign and the president of Emerge America. Also in legal news involving the president, an advice columnist who claimed that President Trump had sexually assaulted her in a New York City department store dressing room back in the 1990s, is suing the president for alleged defamation. E. Jean Carroll filed her lawsuit this morning in New York. It says that the president harmed her reputation and career when he said she was lying and that he'd never even met her. Carroll first made the allegation in a New York Magazine article back in June. At the time, President Trump said she was totally lying and said she's not my type. He also said that he'd never met her, though there is a 1987 photo that shows him and Carroll with their spouses at the time. So more legal news involving President Trump. In the meantime, when it comes to impeachment, White House officials expected not to show up today for their scheduled testimony as they refused to take part. And of course, last week we had the formal House vote for the impeachment inquiry, formalizing the process, and public hearings are expected within the coming weeks. Meanwhile, you've got a Twitter war between President Trump and Governor Gavin Newsom. The president criticizing California over its spate of wildfires, talking about California going hat in hand to the feds to get money to fight the fires, and the president claiming that California's policies, including water policies, are heavily involved in the problems with the fires. And Pete, I wanted to ask you about that because Governor Newsom's response was that since the president is a climate denier, he's out of the conversation for that. But there is a conservative critique that PG&E, because of having to spend far more for electricity than it would otherwise for renewable sources, that had a negative impact on their investment in their infrastructure and making it able to withstand wind threats. Your thoughts, is there a legitimate debate to be had here over California climate policies and more dangerous fires?
Well, I don't think we yet know, Larry, but I do think that it is a very important line of questioning to engage on. I mean, suffice it to say, the blue state model for California has always been you pay more in taxes and fees and, in our case, electricity bills, but you get more back. Right. And on the electricity side, it's been what you get more back is cleaner air because we're investing in more renewables and alternative energy sources. If it can be shown that Californians, either through the legislature or through regulations by the Public Utilities Commission, has forced utilities to divert resources that would have gone to the safety measures that even the governor himself has cited the utilities for failing to implement. We're talking microgrids, emergency shutoff systems. If those funds were diverted to invest in renewable energy sources, then we've gotten the worst of both worlds. We've gotten high energy costs, and through the fires, we're actually creating more greenhouse gases and making the environment even worse.
Of course, the progressive response and critics of PG&E would say the utility probably wouldn't have put that money into hardening its infrastructure. It would have gone to the profits of shareholders instead of investing in its own mega grid. Amanda Renteria, any thoughts on this?
Well, that's exactly the question that will come up is, well, what would have gone to profits? What would have gone to actually investments? But listen, I think there's no doubt that these fires, everything that's happened with PG&E is a real question for our state legislature, for the governor to take a look at. And particularly, I think you're beginning, obviously, hearing it from constituencies all across wherever you live in California. And so this is really going to ask some questions about how we do this in California and what we do going forward so that we can mitigate these problems as we move forward. Because there's no doubt this is devastating to everyone here, whether you're in the fire area or whether you're housing people who that are being affected by it.
The president, in his tweet that was critical of California, also mentioned water policy and sending water to the ocean, referencing there the Delta policy and how much is captured and sent to the South for farmland and whatnot. I wasn't quite sure how that related to I guess the argument would be some of that water would be used for greater irrigation, which would help reduce fire risk. But that's unclear to me what argument he was making there. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the 2020 presidential race. We have a couple of interesting polls that are out and showing historically high interest in the election next year, much earlier than we typically see that. With a polarized electorate, perhaps that's not a surprise given the big field of Democratic candidates. That's probably part of it, too, as people are sort of looking to see who they would want to support early on in the caucus and primary season. So we'll talk about where things stand on that and also the divergent policies of Twitter and Facebook on political ads. I'm interested in hearing what our political analysts think about the approaches, whether they favor one or over the other, or whether they think that there is a better approach than either one. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, back in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on this Monday, and as is our custom, we're talking with political analysts about The big news of just the past few days, joining me, Amanda Renteria, the president of Emerge America, an organization that identifies and trains women to run for public office. It's a Democratic organization. She was the national political director for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign in 2016. Pete Peterson is the dean of Pepperdine University's School of Public Policy and senior fellow at Pepperdine's Davenport Institute. So we have a couple of polls that are out recently which show historically high levels of interest for this early in a presidential campaign. And Amanda, I'm curious what you make of that and what that potentially means for the candidates and for overall turnout in the caucuses and primaries.
Well, I think we saw this exact story play out in 2017 going into 2018. You know, we're a day away from elections, one of which that's very big that people will be watching closely is, of course, Virginia. And we saw a great deal of energy going into those 2017 elections. We saw that built upon in the 2018 elections. And so it's no surprise to me that the momentum continues. But I have to say, what it will mean is a very, very intense election. I think people miss that 2018 not only did a lot of Democrats come out, a lot of new voters come out, but a lot of Republicans came out as well. And so I think we're going to continue to see that trend with an intensity level that I think this country hasn't seen in a very long time, or if ever.
The poll that came out today from the Associated Press and the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research finds when it comes to voter anxiety, a fascinating difference between the two parties. Democrats are far more likely than Republicans to feel anxious during this election season. Two-thirds of Democrats and just under half of Republicans define themselves as anxious. When it comes to frustration, 64% of Democrats, 49% of Republicans. Very, very similar numbers. But what you see here is a tremendous increase in interest. 82% of Democrats say they're tuned into the campaign, 74% of Republicans. Overall, 73% of Americans say they're interested. That's up 7 percentage points from just a few months ago. Pete, your take on where the electorate sits and how this compares to previous races.
Well, I can say that the impeachment hearings and process, I think, is also playing a significant role here. I know a number of Republican friends of mine, and certainly when you're hearing the new narrative coming out of the White House, that this is being the impeachment is being spun in a way that it is an attempt to overturn the 2016 election and prevent President Trump from running again in 2020. Now, this is actually being supported by a couple of the Democrats who voted against the inquiry last week. A couple of them came out and say, why don't we just wait for the presidential election in 2020. But I do think that Democrats really need to be careful as this impeachment inquiry goes on, that if there are attempts again to push this through, and obviously you have a wall in the Senate before any of this would go towards removal from office, there are an increasing number of Republicans that are seeing this, one, as a way of overturning 2016, and B, as a way of trying to prevent Trump from running in 2020. So that's going to engender a lot of interest from Republicans.
The Wall Street Journal NBC News poll that was released yesterday shows 53% of Americans surveyed approve of the House impeachment inquiry, 44% disapprove, and just about half of Americans say Mr. Trump should be impeached and removed from the White House based on what they've heard so far. 46% oppose impeachment and removal. We're into the margin of error in that. Amanda, you couldn't cut it any closer for the division over impeachment.
Right. And I think one thing that's often lost is what are those numbers in the actual states where Republicans have to vote on this, or both in the Senate, and what are the numbers in the districts where congressmen have to vote on this? And that's really the question here. And as this thing moves forward, you know, one of the interesting things that we just don't know yet is what will people say when they see these testimonies, and even more importantly, when they see people come and testify. One of the big questions here, I know the White House is certainly keeping folks from testifying until it is important for them to get their story out. And that will be the question as to whether this process will end up revealing all the different statements by folks who are in the White House, as well as those statements, or at least the transcripts we are reading now.
Also interesting to look at the hypothetical matchups. Now, you know, we're so far away that, but it's still interesting that President Trump's deficit is so big with Democrats. He trails Joe Biden by 9 points in the hypothetical matchup and trails Elizabeth Warren by 8 points, essentially the same margin between the two. And Amanda, it sort of says to me when you look at this that it really is, on for Democrats, it seems, it almost doesn't matter who the nominee is. They're going to support who that person is, regardless. I guess, though, turnout is an issue because there could be some candidates who elicit more passion than others. Is that how you see it?
Absolutely. Turnout, momentum on the ground is everything. And that's what we're going to see once you start to go into your first states and to Super Tuesday. You will see what energy and what momentum is on the ground. And so I appreciate the polls, but many of them are based on name recognition at the moment because there is such a large field. Where that starts to really shape is when you begin to see what do your Iowa caucus goers, what are they energized about? How are they working? What does New Hampshire look like? Nevada, South Carolina? Then we begin to see what's really happening on the ground. And there's no doubt that any Democratic candidate, it's not just about getting voters who have been there already, but how do you grow the electorate and really energize the kind of momentum you're going to need in this election cycle?
Texan Beto O'Rourke dropped out of the campaign as he just couldn't gain enough traction. And Kamala Harris, California's U.S. Senator, really struggling. She stays mired in the bottom tier of the polls and is going to be, in addition to slashing her staff, putting the resources that she's keeping into Iowa. So clearly, where people had expected her to kind of put the emphasis on South Carolina with its large number of African-American voters, it seems there's a shift here. And Pete Peterson, maybe you can comment on this. You know, the most recent New York Times Siena College poll shows Harris still mired at 3% of the Iowa likely caucus goer polling. I mean, that's even putting more resources into Iowa. I mean, this is a huge challenge. Pete? I guess we lost Pete. We'll get him back on the line. Amanda, your thoughts about the challenge for Kamala Harris?
It is a challenge, but I will tell you, it's sort of also not really much of a choice. Folks might not remember, but those Iowa results have a real impact on what happens in the rest of the early four states and into Super Tuesday. And so you simply can't be absent in Iowa. And I think her campaign really saw that. In fact, today with early voting, some of the voting states that are really important, California being one of them, their early voting starts quite before we actually vote in California. And so those early races really do mean something. People will be watching. And I got to tell you, those headlines really matter. And that's what she's pushing for. And I think we're going to see every single one of these candidates make sure that they somehow figure out a way to be in the top three in Iowa.
And you think there's just no way that she can put her eggs in the South Carolina basket where she might do better? You think it's too late?
She can, but you get behind. And that's the problem, is then you're working yourself out of a hole as opposed to making sure that you're in those early states and your momentum continues through and you get a bigger bump come Nevada or come South Carolina. And what I'll say about campaigns cutting costs is there are two things that can happen. One is it is true that it forces a campaign to focus, but it also forces a campaign to take some important risks that could end up being really the difference in setting that stage to winning the nomination. And so we'll see what's going to happen with this campaign. I think every single one of these campaigns is going to go through a process in terms of how do they focus and how do they make make sure that they're taking just the right risks if you're in that second tier candidate pool.
Pete Peterson is back with us. Pete, I was interested in your thoughts on Kamala Harris, her sagging campaign, and the layoffs there, the lack of cash, putting what resources she's got into Iowa instead of holding back and making the emphasis South Carolina with its significant African-American electorate. And Amanda, you know, essentially saying, you know, there really isn't a choice. She's got to improve her standing in Iowa. What do you think?
Well, I agree with Amanda on this uphill battle. The latest Real Clear averages in Iowa have her at 3%, with Warren and Buttigieg leading. So she can put in as many resources as she wants into Iowa. I just don't see that changing the results that seem to be hardening there. The South Carolina piece does show, I mean, that really is Biden's firewall. He continues to be performing very well there relative to the other early primary states. He's doubled up on Warren, 35-15. And I think it, in some ways, it certainly surprises me, but it shows how powerful a presence and an identity that President Obama was. Biden is essentially drafting off of his connection to President Obama. And most all the African-American votes in South Carolina are going to Biden and not to Harris, which I think also just shows that some of the identity politics that we've thought in some ways that if you are an African-American candidate, you're going to draw African-American votes. That's not necessarily the case.
Well, and she's had such a difficult time really crafting an identity in the field. Elizabeth Warren's got all the policy proposals and just put out the financial underpinnings for her Medicare for All plan. Joe Biden's got name recognition and the association with President Obama. Buttigieg has the sort of, you know, the personal charisma that at least for a certain segment of the electorate is connecting, although I know he has challenges outside of that group. And Bernie Sanders has been around and has his hardcore devotees. So sort of, you know, Pete, where does she go?
Lane, yeah. Well, there really is
lane?
One. I mean, yeah, there was a moment there in one of the first debates where she took on former Vice President Biden on the busing issue, and that was a glimmer that came and went within a few days. And then she took that punch on the chin from Congressman Gabbard in one of the following debates, and she just hasn't seemed to recover from that. I agree with you that there doesn't seem to be a lane there as it relates to policy. She kind of seems to be more of a I agree with so-and-so, as opposed to coming forward with her own set of policy proposals. And she really hasn't found her footing or identity separate from these other leading candidates.
And I wanted to ask you what you thought about the divergent political advertising policies of Facebook and Twitter. Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook CEO, saying that they will accept political ads, but that the platform is not going to vet them. It'll be up to, other candidates to correct or advertise back against false claims. And Twitter going just the opposite, not accepting any political advertising whatsoever. Do you prefer one of those over the other, or think that there's a better third way?
I think we both, anyone in this space must do something. And I think that's the piece that really fell flat for Facebook this last week, is that you saw Twitter take an action, do something about it. And you saw Facebook respond with, hey, listen, this is only 0.5% of my revenues. And even that statement alone really indicates the distance here. I mean, here is Facebook CEO talking to Congress members who are being told somebody may actually put campaigns that are misleading about you. And his long-term, or after thinking a little bit more about it, his response is, you know, these revenues are small. And so I think what we've got to see here is people feel a responsibility to our democracy, feel a responsibility to fair and free elections. And I do think what we're seeing out of the cable companies, the kind of regulations that they have to put on before they air an ad, seems to be the right avenue to go. How do you get there from Facebook? I'd like to see them do something, tell folks what it is. And frankly, I think the public's willing to actually hear ideas and solutions from them.
Yeah, my question is how you fact check in a way that gets broad buy-in, because I think there are just so many gray areas and claims in political ads that it almost depends how you hear the claim that's made as to whether it's factual or not. I mean, obviously there are some things that are clearly false, but once you get past the demonstrably false, people aren't going to be happy with you not calling out other things that, you know, a lot of people think are false, but not everyone agrees. Pete, do you think it is possible to do fact-checking and deny certain political ads in an equitable way?
I think it's extremely difficult. And I was surprised by Zuckerberg's testimony recently. You know, as a university, we advertise on Facebook. And because we're a graduate policy school, we've run afoul of some of Facebook's own measures, believing or trying to test if we're a political organization. We obviously host speakers with political backgrounds or speak on policy issues. And I'm surprised that Zuckerberg seems a little more laissez-faire, just given all the hurdles we've had to jump as a university, even in discussing ways that we can promote greater viewpoint diversity. We've had trouble getting those ads passed and ability to promote boost in Facebook terms, boosting those ads on Facebook.
Hmm. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about faith, religious faith among the candidates, how much of a factor that is. We'll talk about the different ways they talk about their personal faith, if they do, and be a chance for you to weigh in as well. How much do you consider, if at all, a candidate's relationship to her or his faith? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Back after a live update from Eddie Lynn Erdes.